You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith and I'm sitting in Wellington in a lovely hotel which has an eye-watering amount of mirrors and brightly coloured wallpaper in it. So I'll try and concentrate as I introduce to you, recorded here at the New Zealand International Comedy Festival. I actually recorded this interview last week in Auckland. This is with the lovely Ben Hurley. He's a wonderful dude, very, very funny. As you'll hear, I knew him when he was working in the UK and he's now back living in Auckland and living in Wellington, I think, actually. No, I can't remember. I'm sure we'll explain on the interview in due course. But he is really funny. And blow me, he's famous. That was fun to step off the plane and suddenly see Hurley's face on billboards. So here we go. This is Ben Hurley, and I hope you enjoy it. I'll speak to you in a bit. Ben, thank you for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
For shushing you as soon as you walked in so that we could do it on this.
Yeah, no, I've never been great at taking direction.
Yeah. So you lived in this hotel. When was that?
I lived here when I lived in the UK and I came home here to do the comedy festival 1 year and I stayed for about 3 months.
Okay.
And so I lived in this hotel and it's a nice hotel, but it's for 3 months is quite a long time.
Yeah, man, that is a way. I think I've just got 2 weeks this time and then I'm doing a week in Wellington.
Because you've been in New Zealand, what, like 9 times in the last 2 years?
I've been here 3 times. I came for the festival last year and then I came for World Buskers in January.
Yes.
And then I came back for...
It's a marvellous festival. I mean, New Zealand Comedy Festival is too, but
yeah,
the World Buskers is a marvellous festival.
I felt very lucky to have the busking angle to get me in there.
Yeah.
Because I think, you know, what it's one of those ones where the gig is so beautiful, you kind of can't go wrong. But... I feel like, you know, there's no way they'd have taken me just as a random British.
Yeah.
I'm also saying that because I don't want loads of British comics to try and get the gig. No, it's special. It's my turf. You know?
Yeah.
So when did you?
And also, there's lots of earthquakes there all the time.
Oh man, it's terrible.
So yeah,
terrible, very dangerous. So for people that don't know you, some people in the UK will know who you are.
A few,
and I knew you, of course, and I can't not bring this up as Big Daddy Comedy.
Yes, which I think came from a story about Mike Wilmot once.
Oh, you were telling me the other night in the pub, yes.
Yeah, he. It's a great piece of advice he gave me once. I think we were about to do a show on the Tattershall Castle, which is, of course, the boat on, you know, on the Thames.
Name the big river in London.
Yes, on that one. And I was the compere and... I was about to go on and there was just a table of lads and I said to Mike, who was first on, I said, those guys are going to be cunts. And he went, hey, I don't want to be Big Daddy Comedy or anything. But never predict. Because even if you're right, it doesn't make you feel any better.
Yeah, right. Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
And sure enough, they were.
Yeah.
And I came off and looked at him and he went, feel any better?
Yeah. And then you said to me, I don't remember what the advice was that you gave me at the time, but I did love that phrase of, I don't want to be Big Daddy Comedy. Because there's something about, I really like that aspect of comedy whereby people are always trying to help each other and say useful things, a lot more than you'd think from the outside.
Yes, I think so. And I think, well, you and I worked a lot together. I think, if, and I hope this isn't an insult to you, but I thought at the time we're on a very similar kind of level of gigs and stuff in the UK. And
we I think you were a couple of rungs above me, I think.
Possibly. But,
I was driving.
Maybe. We used to do a lot for Christian and Christian Mills. And Off the Curb, I think you and I would be the road warriors that we were. And... yeah, I feel like I need a certain level of comfort with another comic before I give them advice.
Sure, sure.
Particularly in the UK, where everyone's definitely got a plan and their own thing.
How do you mean?
Well, it's a very serious business in the UK. It's a very professional and competitive circuit, which isn't a bad thing. I'm not saying that in a bad way at all, but everyone kind of... Not everyone, but most people who get into it now or have got into it maybe in the last 10 years get into comedy with the plan to make it a career and have longevity and they definitely have an idea of what they want to be on stage and where they want to get to. And whereas I think in New Zealand, although it's starting to change, you know, it's a bit more haphazard and you just kind of...
Sure.
Give it a crack, and then you know people pay you. Then you keep doing it, and if they stop, you stop.
And you're talking now as someone who I remember when I came here last April,
mm-hmm.
I like got off the plane and saw a poster with your face, like a billboard with your face on it. Went, right. Holy shit, Hurley's famous. Which, to be fair, when were you last living in the UK? It's been a while.
Yeah, 2009. I've been here 5 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so, but you are at the level in New Zealand where you're like a regular, recognise him in the street kind of guy.
I guess so now. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're obviously someone who started, like a lot of guys in the UK and kind of what we think of now as like the old guard of alternative comedy.
Mm-hmm.
They were people who went into it thinking, oh, I love making people laugh.
Sure.
I'm a bit of a weirdo. I don't fit in. I'll try this. And now they're the guys who are commanding good salaries, driving nice cars and appearing on TV a lot. You know, it's almost like if you think of the old guard, people like, you know, well, I think of someone like Jack D.
Sure, right.
You know, that's an incredibly rich career mm-hmm. with loads of possibilities and one would imagine a fair amount of cash from various, you know, advertising endeavours, telly, DVDs, tours, all the rest of it.
Absolutely. I mean, I was always amazed, just because our industry's younger here, and so when I started, I was just always amazed that you could really make a living from this. And
what was the landscape when you started?
So there was probably 4 or 5 recognisable comics, you know, that you would see pop up on TV from time to time.
Would British listeners know any of those?
Brendan Lovegrove would probably be one of the few he worked in the UK for a few years. So he was Lovegrow. There's Cal Wilson, who
Show.
Yeah, oh, right, there you go.
Yeah.
And a bloke called Radar, who's now a sort of, he's kind of our, I was gonna say Bear Grylls, but he's much less annoying.
okay.
And a guy called Mike King, who is a Maori fella. And probably Ewan Gilmore, who is our kind of Australian and New Zealand listeners will know what I mean when I say bogan.
Okay, yeah, sure.
Yeah, it's quite an Australasian thing. It's not quite a chav.
Yeah, it's almost like the idea of a chav, but with a certain amount of pride in being a bogan. A bogan's proud to be called bogan.
Certainly, yeah. Certainly proud to be called bogans, and there's a lot more heavy metal kind of influence.
Sure. Mullets and muscle cars.
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah.
Okay.
So there were those 5 people, and they were recognisable everywhere, and then there was kind of a that's when I got into it, and I mean I literally got into comedy maybe, and I was living in Wellington, and there was this young duo who were trying things out at the time there called Flight of the Conchords, mm-hmm. who we all thought were great,
mm-hmm.
But no one knew who they were, and they, you know, they were literally only 1 or 2 years deep into the industry, sure. deeper than me.
Sure.
So
was there, when you say the industry, what was, you said you didn't necessarily know that you could make a living from telling jokes?
I sure.
mean, were there open spot clubs? Was there an open spot circuit? Or was it a case of just turning up and asking to do a gig in a pub sort of thing?
Right. So, yeah, basically that was kind of, you kind of had to make your own work. There was no circuit to speak of. I think the classic comedy bar started in Auckland the year that I started. But I lived in Wellington. I lived in another city, so that was kind of the kind of mecca. And
okay,
yeah.
So I'm just processing that. You started in the same year as the Classic.
Yeah.
So it's like 20 years ago, is it?
13 years ago.
Yeah. Oh, 13. I thought the Classic 13, was 14. Okay. Yeah.
It was kind of Auckland definitely had more of a scene, and obviously it had a full time comedy club. But I was in Wellington, and so they had fit with fringe festivals and things like that. So that's where I did my first gig.
And had you'd seen those comics before, what, on TV, or just had you gone to comedy gigs yourself?
Yeah, there was a TV show called Pulp Comedy, which had three acts and a host, mm-hmm. and was a half-hour TV show. Okay. And that had been going maybe 3 or 4 years when I started. Yeah.
Okay.
But also, whenever they needed a comedian for something, that was basically one of those five people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you saw that and went, I could do that? I mean, you were a funny kid in school?
Yeah, I was always trying to be funny. I think everyone's funny at school. Everyone's kind of operating MO is that they try and make people laugh, isn't it?
I don't know, is it?
I don't know. I always found everyone funny. All my friends were funny. I went to a co-ed school and, the girls made each other laugh and made guys laugh, and guys were always trying to make girls laugh to impress them, and everyone was kind of funny, and then everyone just went and got real jobs, and
and some of us went, hang on a minute,
yeah.
So what was that? I mean, I know for me, the more I think about it now, I think my impetus was partly how can I make people think I'm special, and partly how can I not get a real job. So what were those similar things for you? What were your kind of what were the cornerstones of you thinking, I'm having a go at this?
I loved comedy, so I had a real...
I should have said that one as well.
But that actually kind of stopped me doing it earlier. Even though I did my first gig at 21 years of age, I almost wanted to do it earlier, and I kind of decided I wouldn't, because I liked comedy too much, and I was never going to be as good as, Seinfeld or Letterman.
That's a good point. That doesn't come up so often, but I think lots of people think that. You know, it's not necessarily the fear of being heckled that stops you. It's the fear of going, I don't want to tarnish the thing I love. It's almost like a guitarist. Like, you think of guitarists as going, one day I'm going to be Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah, right.
You don't really think of them as going, I don't want to piss on the idea of Jimi Hendrix by trashing this, you know.
Totally. I just didn't... I thought I could... I guess what I didn't know about comedy was how much better you get at it by doing it. That's something that a lot of people don't know. I mean,
that's a really good point.
I thought you kind of had it or you didn't, and you sunk or swam within your first few gigs, and that was it. And I didn't really realize that the more you work at it, the better you become in most cases. Mm-hmm. Yeah, obviously you have to have a basis of natural talent.
Do you think anyone can be turned into a comedian?
I don't think so, no. I used to. I think there's people who are just naturally... I don't know Jason Byrne's process. He's someone that strikes me as just having funny bones. I don't know how much actual work he does, or whether he just can... Or he just makes it appear effortless.
Mm-hmm. It's difficult to tell that, because we've seen acts that you go, it appears effortless, but I know how much the work is going on.
Yeah.
But then there are acts where you go, maybe this is just effortless. I mean, I've interviewed Andrew Maxwell for the show, and mm-hmm. he basically said he doesn't write. He just spends all day reading, researching, looking at the internet, watching telly, and just goes on and talks about what he thinks.
Wow.
And you sort of go, you probably do, you fucker.
Yeah,
do you
know probably, what I mean? Yeah. He's like a savant or something, though, isn't he?
Yeah, right.
I think someone like, someone with Jason Byrne's kind of natural ability to, entertain, possibly, this is just the way I'm reading it, not knowing his process, he doesn't necessarily have to put in as much work as other people who maybe don't have just that natural funniness, and they need to be cleverer on stage. Okay. And I don't say that in a disparaging way about Jason at all, but you've just got to work harder at being... saying clever things. They don't just come naturally to people on stage sometimes.
So what was your first gig? Were you trying to say clever things? Were you trying to banter? What was your...
Yeah, no, I was definitely trying to say clever things. I was very studious. And it's one of the... I'm pathologically lazy. I'm quite clever, but I'm very, very lazy. And it was one of the first things I really... And I was at university at the time. But this was one of the first things I really, really tried hard to... to do, and spent hours and hours and hours writing and perfecting and rehearsing. And so my first gig was in the Wellington Fringe Festival, and it was hosted by Benjamin Crellin, who is another Kiwi comic who's done some work in the UK. He was, you know, he was a kind of up-and-coming comic in New Zealand at the time, and had his own kind of late-night chat show in the Fringe Festival, and we'd become friends, and he thought I was a funny guy or whatever, and we had fun conversations together, and he booked me for my first gig. So, and
that was that back in the days when people would try and convince other people to start?
Yeah.
Very different
to
now.
Totally, yeah.
Oh, you'd be great at this. It's loads of fun. Come and join in. Yeah, join the party. Yeah.
Yeah, which it was, because no one's getting making any money back then.
Yeah, sure.
Certainly not here. And it's something that I kind of miss, is that there were people like Rhys Darby, for example, who lived in Christchurch and heard about this place called the Classic Comedy Bar and moved to Auckland just to do more gigs. And, you know, he was getting $40 a gig.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't certainly... He moved to Auckland to go on the dole just to do more gigs. Mm-hmm. And that, people don't really do that anymore.
Yeah, sure. I think Yeah, but I suppose the equivalent would be moving to London or Manchester or Edinburgh in order to find a scene. But I think now there's very much the idea that... And that will be... Not if it's not, you know, it's not like the path is... you know, paved with gold, but I think people do think there's something out there beyond me having a good time and expressing myself.
Yes, I think you're right. I don't know what I was going to say anyway.
Let's talk about the clever things. What were your first lot of clever things? What were you writing about at the time?
Very heavily influenced by Seinfeld, I think, at the time.
Oh, he was your big guy. Okay.
He was my big guy. So very observational. You know, very, did you ever notice? It was 2001, so that wasn't quite so passe. And,
yeah. Hey, no one's noticed anything. Quick, let's start noticing stuff.
Yeah. So let me think. I mean, a typical sort of open spot fare of, there was an advert on the time at the time that was for sanitary pads, actually, that was quite strange. So an analysis of that. I didn't really know who I wanted to be on stage, so there was a bit of observational, a bit of rude, which I can't quite remember now. I even think I did half a song parody, which is awful.
Oh, like a pop song with the change the lyrics?
Yeah, where I change the lyrics.
Oh, come on.
I know. But yeah, hey, so there's honesty. You want honesty? There too. I did a song parody.
Excellent. Very good. So you put all that stuff together from when you're... Because you're an observationalist now.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
So in the beginnings of you kind of growing those antenna for observations, let's just talk about those for a while.
Sure.
What's the secret, do you think, of a good observation? Or what were you... What did you think it was then from your interest in Seinfeld? What were you taking from him? The most inspiring?
Right, so what he does, which I think is very unique, is he doesn't personalise observations. I think maybe it was the style of the time and you could kind of get away with it back then because it was so new, but he does go, did you ever notice, or do you ever notice this? And whereas I can't, you know, I don't think you can do that anymore. I think to make an observation work, it has to be from your unique worldview. So,
okay.
So
that's interesting. Can you think, does anyone at the moment, can you think of any acts that do not personality free, but totally universal observational stuff? I mean, so would someone like McIntyre do that? It's not like I feel like this about such and such.
No, true. In fact, yeah, McIntyre or Carl Barron from Australia. It's just not as common now, I guess. Maybe as I'm not saying it's passé, but it's I think people want a little bit more of you in your comedy now. Maybe.
Yeah, it's funny to think we've just named two, and I don't know Carl Barron's reputation. I've heard him. I know he's successful.
Very successful.
Just in terms of, you know, we've named Seinfeld and McIntyre. I don't think people want that.
No, do
you
know what I mean? True.
It's quite...
Yeah, you're right.
I'm not disagreeing with you, but I think... I do wonder if... Like, my stuff is sort of super personal. And I sometimes wonder, am I tripping over my own feet? You know, how much do people care about my life experience? Maybe what they want to do is imprint their life experience on what you're saying. You know, they want, to a certain extent, they want you, the comic, to disappear so they can go, oh, I'm like that.
Well, that's certainly what those guys do, and very skillfully. Maybe more the point is I can't do that particularly well.
Sure, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. But you started. That was, we were just talking about how you started off. You were trying to do, you're invisible. This is the thing that's out there, were you?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Here's something that I noticed, which you probably all noticed too. Maybe it's easier to personalize it as well.
Because to
do an invisible, as you say, observation, it has to be completely and totally universal.
That's it. Yeah. Absolutely. You could, because if you do an observation that only half the room have observed, you can fudge it by going, and it made me feel like this.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And then there's something that can scoop up the other people. Right.
And you bring your character into it. And, you know, if people don't necessarily relate to the observation that you've made, then they can kind of go, oh, yeah, but you would, because you're a scruffy, overweight New Zealander.
So, yeah, they can see it through your eyes rather than the observation being so good that they see it through their own eyes. Mm. Ooh, I'm quite excited by that. I think we've hit something. That's a really good point. Yeah.
But maybe that's the thing, when you're starting out and you don't have any confidence in your own ability or the ability for the audience to like you, you don't personalize things so much because, I don't know, I certainly didn't. I just didn't think people would care what I thought.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And did you find that they did? Obviously that changed over time.
Yeah, I think just, it's such a life-changing thing to start being good at comedy because, well, it just gives you confidence out of that you've never found before.
Yeah.
And it's maybe false confidence.
Yeah, but you start interesting. Yeah.
But you start walking around thinking, people do care what I think.
Yeah, right. Were you a particularly shy or unconfident sort of a kid, or is it just that it made you see the world in a different way?
No, I certainly wasn't a shy or unconfident kid. I've never had any problem there.
Yeah.
but I think everybody at that age, early, you know, late teens, early 20s particularly, is
self-conscious.
You question every single instinct you've ever had, don't you?
Mm.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering, we might be getting ahead of ourselves here, but who do you think you are to your audience now?
Well, most
people, on stage, I mean, absolutely. Right. You know.
Yeah. You mean? I'm quite sure what you mean. Do you mean like, because they feel they know me because I'm on the telly?
No, absolutely not. Okay. I mean, just if an audience who had never seen you before saw you,
Sort
of asking, what's your relationship to them? Are you kind of like the guy that tells the truth about the world? Are you like their friend? Are you like their dad? Are you like, you know what I mean? What's
sure. Oh, okay, cool.
And it's not, really, you know, there may not be a specific answer, but...
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. I don't know. I get, and a lot of Australasian comics get this as the, I get guy down the pub.
Okay.
A lot.
Yeah.
Which I think I read, Asher Trelevin, who's, do you know him?
Of course, you do.
He's one of your people.
He's friend of the show, Carney.
I read that on Twitter that he'd got a guy down the pub a review which he didn't enjoy.
Oh God! That liked him, but in a way that he didn't.
But he's like a guy that you'd meet down the pub and tell you a yarn.
I don't know what pub.
he's the guy that you'd meet down
the fetish club. You know. So yeah, okay. But you get a guy down the pub kind of a way. I suppose it's interesting. I think what I'm matching up is, I got onto this, was you saying that you have a relationship with the world. You know, you have a confidence with the world.
Oh, I see,
you
right.
Certainly come across as very confident on stage. When I saw you last week at the Classic doing a set, you were very, I mean, I know you were talking about being a dad as well, but you were quite sort of paternal.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? There's something, particularly there was a lot of young people in the audience, and... But there's also, you know, you're a big guy, you're beardy, you were talking about your daughter. It really felt like, it's definitely man down the pub rather than boy down the pub.
I guess that's come with age and experience doing comedy. It's kind of cheesy, but it's my mantra.
Do it.
I'm going to do it. If a young comic ever asks me for advice, the thing I always say is, don't ask them if you're funny. Tell them you're funny. And I don't mean actually say, hi, I'm funny.
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean? Like, with the way that you deliver, you always tell them that you're funny.
Yeah.
That's why new material never, ever quite works the same as when you've done it a few times and you like it and you're confident with it. Sure. Because you're going out there going, hey, do you guys like this? And I don't think that is ever as good.
It gives them space to go, maybe not.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. I guess that's... And I talk about this on stage as well. When you become a father, you just... You know, you've made someone with your dick, so you don't really care about what other people think anymore.
Yeah, okay, that's interesting who you say. I think I'm there's a bit of material I'm considering putting in my show at the moment, which is about my desire to be a dad.
Yeah,
and I don't know whether I'll put it in, so I don't know if it breaks some sort of contract between the performer and the audience. But one of my concerns is, if I have a kid, I might not give a fuck about comedy anymore.
Right, so this is my piece of material that I'm doing at the moment. It's in my show about where dad humour comes from, because we all know dad humour, and that is something that's been explored by other comics. There's no doubt about that. But what I'm trying to say is dad humour comes from men really not caring about what the rest of the world thinks of them anymore at all.
Yes, I see.
Because you've made your own people.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, that's interesting.
And
yeah.
As a comedian, you have to care. I have to care what people think of my humour. Because that's my job, so it's keeping the dad humor away is a constant battle.
is that true? That's an excellent observation. It's not going for the cheesy laugh, because what the fuck?
Yeah. Exactly.
That's actually nice. That's a very wholesome sentiment.
Trying my best to have it not creep in.
So finally, we get to hear from Daddy Comedy. I think that's a very good point about people passing down advice from one comic to another. It's nice when you ask for it. It's nice when people proffer it unsolicited. But it isn't always, and I am terrible for giving out unsolicited advice to people who I was going to say who I consider beneath me. That's not what I meant at all, but on the ladder, beneath me on the metaphorical ladder. And equally, people who are many, many rungs above me as well. I just love going, I mean, who doesn't? Who doesn't like to say to someone, Oh, do you know what? You could tweak that bit and here's a tag. But equally, I'm a bastard for going up to people I barely know and saying, quality control, that joke dragged you down. I'm really trying to put an end to it. So apologies to anyone in the past I've done that to. But yes, great. Thank you to Ben for coming along for the show. Really enjoying this one. I've got some previews, some little bits and bobs to plug. If you're in the UK, if you're in London, on the 10th of June, I'll be doing a preview at the Harrison. You can look up the Harrison pub. That's near Euston. Have a Google of that. I'm doing an hour, as is the brilliant Canadian madman John Hastings. So that'll be a lot of fun, the 10th of June. And at the 18th of June at the Pleasance London, that's just me, myself and I doing a little preview there. Come along to either of those. I've now, by the time you hear this, I'll have done something like 12 shows here in Auckland and Wellington, and it's really taking shape. I'm very excited. I'm very pleased about it. As ever, this is awful. This is a low use of my podcast. But if you are a booker and you've got any preview space, I really don't want the show to lag between me getting back to the UK at the end of May and going up to Edinburgh at the end of July. So if you do have a preview space and you'd like a pretty ready Edinburgh show, I hope... in that space, then do give me a shout, info@comedianscomedian.com. On the subject of Edinburgh, I've got some great news. Alistair Tremblay-Birchall, who you'll remember from an episode a year ago or so, is coming to Edinburgh with an insane show where he tries to list everything. I've not spoken to Alistair, I've just heard this from some other acts. And I've always hoped that if I've introduced you to a guest, if there's someone that you didn't know about, that you, my lovely listenership, would then mob them when they came over to the UK. So please make that happen. Give Alistair Tremblay-Birchall a crowd at Edinburgh. I don't have any details on his show. I'm just putting his name in your head, reminding you this was the guy we talked to about the mathematical formulas of jokes. He's very, very exciting. So please give Alistair a crowd this Edinburgh, and that will help make me look like some sort of mysterious and benevolent force in comedy. That would be nice for everyone. Thank you very much for your emails and your tweets. I've had some very kind feedback from lots of you, as ever. The Carey Marks podcast went down very well, and I will get him back on the show. We could have talked for hours more. He's so intelligent and so funny. So lots and lots of more stuff to talk about with Carey. I hope we'll do that in due course. And I mentioned offers of stuff. If you would like to do a live ComCom, I've got a couple of those in the pipeline, possibly at the Stourbridge Festival. There's possibly another one at Stoke-on-Trent coming up. If there's particular comics you know that live near those areas that you think would be good on the show, do give me a shout. And as well, I may regret this. But on Facebook, if you remember the Facebook group, I've noted I want to just make a little inroad for you to recommend some people for me to go and see this Edinburgh. I'm beginning to realise that I need to widen the circle of the comedians I know. People, you know, there's a lot of people I gig with on the circuit, but there's also a lot more new and exciting people coming through. For example, Matt Ewins. I've talked about Matt on the show before. I'm a huge fan of his. He's on his fourth hour this year. He still hasn't really smashed the roof in terms of profile. He hasn't kind of broken through. But he's a genuinely mental and brilliant act. So people like Matt Ewins, who you think I may not have heard of, people who've done a couple of hours, I'm not looking for absolute newbies at the moment, but if you've done a couple of 3 hours, no, not if you, this is how it's going to work. I would like you to recommend specific acts on the Facebook page for me to take a look at in Edinburgh. People you think I won't have heard of, people who are newish, but not so new that they haven't kind of got themselves figured out. And leave me a sample joke. There's 1,500 people on the Facebook group, so I don't think it's too public a forum to do that. If you are championing someone, that's it. That's exactly it. Don't just be like, I like this guy. If you are championing someone, then put a note on the Facebook group and I will try very hard to get to see them at Edinburgh. I tend to go and see, you know, between seeing my friends and the people I see every year, that's already 60 plus shows, but I'm going to try and widen the net. So do that. And that's only to comics. I'm afraid I won't be taking suggestions from PR people or agents at this stage. I just like to get the word on the street rather than obviously there'll be people who have to champion people in a professional context. This is in a strictly non-professional context. So just send me one sentence of one act I should know about and get on the Facebook group to do that. You can easily find that on Facebook, of course. And thank you, finally, for donating. Of course, your generosity never ceases to amaze me. Thank you, guys. I really appreciate it. ComediansComedian.com and hit the PayPal button to donate whatever you like to the show. I've really been enjoying adopting this model of giving away free stuff and asking for donations if you want to give them. I've been handing out free copies of my album, Princess Uncle Stew, here in New Zealand. And actually, people respond really well to the idea of saying, this is free, or you can give me $5. Some pay, some don't. Everyone feels great about life. So the same rules apply here. Feel free to support the show. Feel free not to. But if you'd like to, then pick a figure and hit the PayPal button at comedianscomedian.com. 5, 10, 20, I nearly said bucks. I've become naturalised. 5, 10, 20 quid or whatever the equivalent is in your local currency. And again, if you're a high roller, then you can really impress me by donating £1 a show for the ones you've listened to. As ever, please don't set up a regular payment. For some reason, they just don't seem to work. I'll get on this, I promise. That's all the blurb for now. Now let's get back to Daddy Comedy, Mr. Ben Hurley.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
You back as a comic starting out, trying to be clever, not having learned those lessons about confidence and not being a dad at the time, rest of it. What was it you were sort of searching for, or what was it you were giving the audience then? Why do you think you were successful enough to continue? Did you have good jokes?
I had good jokes.
Okay.
I had good jokes, and I found, though, that my second year doing comedy is probably still to this day the hardest year I've ever done comedy. It wasn't my first year. I had a really great five that, as I said, I was very studious about about writing and perfecting.
And you were honing it rather than chucking in new stuff all the time. You were going, let's get this to work.
Let's get this to work.
Yeah, I never... It took me ages to get my head round. Have an incredible 10 or right. 5 or whatever that always works. I'd be going, oh, I've got to kind of prove that I can make funny stuff about everything. So, you know,
right.
5 years in, you're like, great, I've got an hour of stuff that half works. You right. know, or whatever, 2 hours or whatever.
You tried to jump up the mountain.
classic Goldsmith. Yeah.
And in my second year, because I'd had this amazing 5, I was getting booked to do longer sets.
Of course.
And I always said yes, out of A, necessity, and B, slight arrogance.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
hey, man, you know, the arrogance engendered, I think, by having an incredible 5 that
works. I guess so, yeah.
And then that 5 ends and you've got 5 left. I mean, but Bigley talks about this, of just going, I thought I had longer. And it's just suddenly, oh, I'm not magic anymore. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I used to just do the sandwich thing. I'd put my good 2 at the start and a good 3 at the end and have filler for...
Bit of a chat. Yeah. Where are you from, sir? Yeah.
And the other thing was, because there was just not a lot of gigs around and I kind of had to take everything, but also... I got influenced by other people then. I saw real live comics and someone like Brendan Lovegrove, who was just incredible with the crowd.
I've met Brendan.
Right.
I've never been in the room. I've never seen his act. I'm aware of his kind of stature. I know his show this year is called 20 Years, which is like a slam. Kind of
yeah, really.
So what does he do that inspired you specifically? You don't need to cover
it. He was just the best live comic in the country. And so he was great with the crowd. He doesn't really talk to the crowd as much anymore. He had great jokes, but he was just so great at just, you know, who are you and what do you do?
Mm.
And at the time, I'd never seen that before. I'd never seen someone on their feet just talk and just have it. As someone who was a new comic, who was so studious over my material, to go, wow, I don't think he's done a joke in 20 minutes.
Mm.
And he probably had, but just was very good at hiding that. But just going, who are, and he was dangerous and offensive and just kind of exciting rock and roll guy. So it kind of very much changed the kind of comic I wanted to be and what I found exciting and interesting from, you know, TV friendly Seinfeld to
raw,
real
dirty
real life
on your feet is a really good expression. He was on his feet,
absolutely on his feet. Yeah, and when I was. I saw Ross Noble early on as well and just was blown away. And that was really annoying because he was like 3 years older than me.
Yeah, there's a theory that goes back and forth with some of the people I interview about whether or not comedy is a meritocracy.
Mm.
Whether or not that's true, it's certainly true that you are not better because you're older or because there's no... Do you know what I mean? You can... feeling of being eclipsed and going, oh, here's a 17-year-old that's just got the best joke I've ever heard. And you kind of go, great.
Yeah, totally. I think the only thing that age gives you is more problems. So you've got more stuff to draw on, you know.
I see what you mean. You're more universal because you've lived through more experiences.
Yeah. And you get respect from more for more of the audience. So if you, and you must have come across this a bit with your youthful looks, that certain material that you've done, some people, particularly early on, just wouldn't believe that you've experienced that.
Yeah, sure.
Would you?
Yeah, I think so. I think I definitely. It's a funny one. I'm quite pretty.
Yes.
And so whether or not I'm looking youthful specifically, I do look like I don't have any problems.
Yeah.
And that's maybe a similar sort of territory. I don't know that I ever noticed it in terms of my youth because, as we know, I came into this from... You know, I'd already done performance for 10 years. Yeah. I'm not saying that word anymore. I'm just... basically, my audience have started having a go at me for always mentioning it. I didn't say the word. My point is, before I was a stand-up, I did other stuff for 10 years.
Okay.
So I felt like I had a certain amount of either confidence or... I don't want to say gravitas, but I had a kind of a connection that I think got over the youthful thing. But I do think that I sometimes look a bit sort of squeaky clean or...
Sure.
You know, delicate.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I am.
There's, a couple of younger comics that I've mentored over the years. I've just said, you know, I don't know that you can swear as much as you are, because it just, for some reason, it's kind of great.
Oh, you said that to younger colleagues. Yeah. Okay.
And it kind of...
It looks like you're showing off as well when you're a kid.
Totally, yeah.
And now my wanking jokes, and you're like, okay, you're excited that you can say that.
Yeah, which nobody enjoys.
Sure.
Whereas, you know, Mike Wilmot, to go back to him, like, he's just such an old, grizzled soul that you kind of, that guy's...
Yeah, he has earned the right to describe his balls slapping around. Yeah. Once they can slap around like that, you're allowed to talk about it.
Yeah. And I think also, it's not just about rudeness either. It's about if you're going to say, if you're going to make an observation about the world, it's age, it definitely helps.
Yes, like, yes, I think so, yeah.
It's, no one wants to hear a 19-year-old go, I'll tell you what the problem with women is.
Sure, Unless they're a 19-year-old in a room full of 18-year-olds. Do you know what I mean? Unless like a student gig where you see people preening and prowling around the student gigs going, oh yeah, I'm 21, mate, I've seen some things. So you're, how long were you a comic here before you decided to make the leap to work in the UK?
4 years, or 3.5, 4 years. There's an award here called the Billy T Award, and I won that, and that's
like, for people that don't know, it's kind of like the Perrier, except they...
Newcomer, though.
Oh, it's a newcomer.
Yeah.
But you get nominated, and then the winner is revealed like 6 months later, all the nominees are given help and support and photo shoots. And, do you know what I mean? It's exactly what the awards in Edinburgh, the Newcomer Awards, should be.
Sure.
But I guess can no longer be, because people deliberately, you know, I don't know if you know, people in Edinburgh do that thing of like taking a 39-minute show up 3 years running, so they're not eligible for newcomer.
Wow.
And then they do a 41-minute show, or whatever it is. I don't know. Amazing. But, yeah, I want to make it clear, I'm not knocking the current Edinburgh Newcomer Awards, because I think it has spiralled out of control to the extent that you couldn't do that again. You'd need to start another... I'm so jealous. I think it's incredible, the circuit here, and I love the way that the idea of a newcomer award is infused with... These guys are great. We're proud of them. Let's help them rather than...
Yeah.
Let's try and pick a winner and then I'll, you know, that'll help.
It's fraught with its own problems.
Is it really? No.
People, no matter what the situation, people will always have a bit of a whinge. So,
Sure. And I'm aware I'm coming to this as an alien, popping here for a week or two at a time, having the best time of my life.
Yeah, sure.
Rather than seeing it, you know, grind through a year of...
I did it once. You know, some people have been nominated 5 times. I think that's the limit. I did it once and won it, and it was the greatest thing, because it was a really hard process. Really hard. I mean, it's 6 months of thinking about it and stressing about it.
And what? How's it resolved in the end? You get nominated, and then you write a show.
Yeah,
you come up with a concept. Your nomination.
Yeah, you come. You go pitch it, because it's a grant, you see, rather than a prize.
Oh, I see.
So you go and pitch your show to the board, and then you do a gig.
So you pitch once you're nominated, or you're nominated on the strength of your pitch?
A pitch and the audition that night.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
And, which, you know, it's just a normal gig, and you go do 5-6 minutes or something. And, then 5 nominees, and then you write your show from there. I mean, you could have written it previously, but no one has. Mm. And, and all the photo shoots and all that stuff, it's really great, but it is, you know, a lot of work pressure. And a lot of focus and a lot of pressure on younger comics to be thinking about that for 6 months. But having said that, I don't think it's necessarily better to do it the Perrier way.
Sure.
Edinburgh
Comedy Award.
Yeah,
right?
Whatever it's called. Yeah.
At the moment, yeah.
Was it Foster's for a while?
It was. Oh, maybe it's still Foster's. It was the If.com Comedy for one.
That's right.
Illustrated year.
I think Phil won when it was there.
Yes, I think so. Yeah, it did.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then there was one year where the panel prize went to everyone that's done a show.
Oh, thanks really?
Thanks for turning up. Yeah, that's great.
Awesome.
So, yeah.
Yeah, so I won that, and that gave us 7,000 New Zealand dollars. So I went to the UK with that to start out. And I was very, very fortunate early on in that. I'd met some really great comics here in New Zealand during the festival who I'd A, gotten along with, and B, they thought I was pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And they helped me get started. And so...
Like British guys?
Yeah.
Who were those?
So Andy Parsons.
Yeah.
Phil Nichol. I previously mentioned Stuart Lee,
mm-hmm.
And also Stu gave me a place to live for 4 months,
yeah,
which
great.
I'm eternally grateful
sure.
for. And it meant I didn't have to get a day job. So Reese Darby's wife Rosie, she was working for Jonglers at the time, and although she couldn't get me straight into those clubs, mm-hmm. she did have influence elsewhere. And I got a call on the second day I was ever in the UK from Jeff Whiting, who just filled my diary on Rosie's recommendation.
Great,
yeah. So I was straight in, and I could do, you know, those sort of mirth control gigs during the week.
And were you opening, closing? What sort of, how long were you doing?
I was either closing or comparing. Okay. Which was, you know, the closing ones, I was right at the edge of what I could do, probably.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's one of the great things about mirth control. There's lots of very good things about mirth control. Yes. There's lots of questionable, you know, people have experiences that they might come away going, was this useful for anyone?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But one of the very useful things is it does... It's great for you going, I can definitely do that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
you'll
totally.
Get opportunity.
Totally.
Yeah.
So I certainly
in the way we knew it now. I guess.
Yeah,
all
yeah.
out of control, you know, in terms of the volume of acts now, but yeah.
I was also very focused about a year before I went that I would only write internationally recognizable
material. Oh, well done.
Material.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas spotted. Now, yeah. Whereas, yeah. So I had a really good 30. I didn't, my 40 was a stretch. So closing was a bit ropey, but what that did was it freed me up to be able to do open spots for the actual weekend clubs.
Yeah, that's great.
Because obviously that most of those mirth control gigs are all during the week.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, I hadn't even thought about that. Absolutely. I mean, I remember that from my own experience. Mm. That is really useful because you have to do a kind of an internal sum, don't you? Go, okay, it's £100 to close Guildford on a Wednesday.
Yes.
And or on a Friday, but if I avoid that £100 on a Friday, then I can do an open spot for somewhere that maybe is going to pay me £200 in 2 years.
Okay. So yeah, that was my early, and it all just, yeah, I just worked really hard. I just said yes to every single gig I could, and I also got some resident comparing, which was amazing as well.
What was the visa situation? Could you just work there, or were you?
Yeah, no, we're allowed, because we are a colony, mm-hmm. New Zealand, we're allowed 2 years.
Oh, gotcha, okay.
Yeah, and then, because I was there 3.5, and then I was sponsored because I got representation with Brett Vincent.
Oh, great, okay.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, of course you were with Brett.
Yeah, right.
Okay. So you were doing what sort of work? Were you still doing observational stuff there? Was there more? Was the personality starting to come through?
It was, if I'm honest, I was so... that first year, I was so just scared and wanting to impress. You know, it was all still mine, but it was all very, oh, I've noticed this about Britain. Oh, I've noticed this about Britain. Oh, sure. You do this about Britain. It was all fairly safe stuff. That's
interesting to hear that as be described as safe. I agree with you. I know what you mean.
Mm.
I wonder if, as a new comic in a strange place, you feel like, I've got to prove that I can do observations about here.
Mm.
Whereas maybe it's a more kind of ballsy tactic or a more confident tactic to go, no, I'm going to give them my act.
It is.
It's weird, isn't it? It's
way more ballsy to give them your act. Way
yeah.
more ballsy. I it took me 2 years probably to actually just, I'd do, you know, obviously I'd do a couple of minutes at the start of, but they were, I thought they were genuinely unique observations as opposed to the same ones as, oh, you guys drink a lot and, you know, the girls wear nothing in the north.
Yeah, sure, sure. They were your own officer, they were your own,
But then I would do my act, and I would even talk about being from, because I'm from small town New Zealand, I'm from country New Zealand, so, you know, I even started talking about that and stuff, and it all seemed to go pretty well. By the time I did, my last thing I did when I was in the UK was, my last major thing was I supported Ed Byrne on tour for 4 months. And by that time I was doing very little local and just doing, I think I was doing 25 to half an hour before him. And yeah, it was all stuff I was genuinely proud of, and it wasn't, and I'd really moved away from just the standard observations, I guess, about Britain.
I remember, I'm just having a memory surfacing of a bit of your stuff that I must have. We did work together a lot. I remember the Kiwi Navy throwing their flip flops at people.
Yeah, yeah. So stuff like that.
That was like a signature bit, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah. Like, and that, you know, people would love that. But you know, it's not. Here, it's a bit of a joke now that comedians all do jokes about how we've got no Navy or Army.
Yes, sure. So but in the day, that was your, you know, it wasn't like that was a hack thing. That was you just describing a facet of life. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, and something kind of, you know, that the British people would enjoy laughing at how tiny we are and cute.
Sure.
Yeah.
And I do. It does make me laugh, actually, every so often whenever on the show I kind of interview someone and we casually describe a topic as hack. That's a whole conversation itself, whether stuff is hack.
Sure.
And whether there's such a thing. But as soon as we slag off an idea or a joke, I do imagine listeners going, oh, I just have to bin my Kiwi Navy. and good. Let's all think harder. Yeah.
I can't remember who said it to me. It was a great piece of advice. Might have even been Kerry Marks. He said that everybody's first thought on a subject shouldn't be what the comedian says.
Yes, yeah, well, Arthur Smith said something similar on this. And the second thought is the thing that clever people think of.
Yes.
And you've got to do the third thought.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great piece of advice.
Yeah, and so, you know, if you think New Zealand Navy, everyone's first thought was, oh, what would that be? That's probably a tiny little boat. You know, right. And you know, while those things can be really universal and kind of recognisable and work in a comedy club situation, I think if you can challenge yourself and go one step further,
they're the first things that when you are reminded of a bit of your material from 5-10 years ago,
yeah,
it's those things that most make you go, oh, yeah, I mean, I did do that.
Totally.
And it was fine. Yeah.
But I also had to pay my rent, so I needed to get into all these places. And I definitely did play a long game. And the sort of changing moment was I'd been back. I always came back to New Zealand to do the comedy festival, and I came back and I did the big show, which you are doing this year.
I was doing last year.
Last year. Yeah. Which is a lineup show, and I was the compere, as you were, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sometimes. Yeah.
And that was really great, and it was really fun. And then the following year, at the end of that run, which was really successful, Scott Blanks, the promoter in New Zealand, owner of the Classic, said, I will give you the Classic next year for 2 weeks if you have 100% new hour.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went back to the UK, and I had to write a new hour in, well, less than a year. It was about 8 months by that point. Mm-hmm. And that was great. Because every single gig I did without you know, Jonglers, the Glee Clubs, anywhere, even when I was trying to impress, I would put a new joke in at least, and those, that time in the train going home is just invaluable.
Oh, so, you were right. Aren't you right post gig?
Yeah.
Yeah, I never do that.
Really?
I should do that.
Yeah.
I come on stage and go, oh, thank God, I'm done, I'm shriven. I write a lot during the day, you know. I find really valuable time is writing before the gig. I try and get to gigs earlier.
Sure.
I get there an hour or two earlier so that I can find a cafe. Yeah, because then I've got all the adrenaline of, holy shit, I've got, you know, my quality control is so much better because I'm thinking, no, I have to save this thing that I'm writing to an actual audience in an hour or two. I can't just write any old bollocks and go, oh, this is brainstorming, I'll come back to it later.
Right.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, right.
You know, I was always post-gig because, you know, work on the piece that you've done and then just kind of my own head for other stories and stuff. And that show was quite a storytellery show.
My own head.
Sorry.
I was like, Mimo. Oh, this is New Zealand technique. I'm a Mimo artist.
I'm going to patent that right now.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So there's no distractions, and this is the days before smartphones as well. So I wasn't.
There's literally no distractions.
There's no distractions on a train. It's unbelievable. I don't know what I'd do now with smartphones. Just be on that the whole time.
So was the plan to go to the UK, train up, and then come home and be brilliant?
Well, Stuart, the plan was to go to the UK and earn good money and maybe never come back. But then I met a girl. And I met a girl 3 months before I went to the UK. And she's now my wife. I flew her over she had to finish her degree. So we we'd known each other 3 months. And then there was 3 months we were apart. And then I flew her to the UK. And so, yeah, she was with me the whole time. And She didn't like the UK after a while, mm-hmm. and I was kind of the same. I just wanted to be at home, and so what I got out of the UK was it made me good. It makes you so much such a better comic than if I'd have stayed here.
And why is that? Is that simply the volume of gigs, or
A the volume and B the probably the competitiveness? I mean, no, I don't think everyone thrives from that, but I certainly did. Yeah,
that's odd. I don't think of you as a. You seem quite, and you always talk about being quite a lazy guy.
Sure.
Oh, when I spoke to you a couple of days ago about this show, you were like, "Oh, you know, you have the process. It's no process, you know."
Yeah, no, no.
But there's, you know,
yeah,
you
do no. Work. Maybe competitive is not the like. Well, it's not competitive in that I want to beat other comics, but it's competitive in that I have to be better than other comics because I need to pay my rent.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like, I don't.
I'm lazy. I really need to earn that bed. So I've got to work hard.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so competitive in that sense. There's no time to rest on your laurels. And I didn't think there was a lot of time to be self-indulgent. Certainly not for me. And I'm not a surreal comic or anything. I can only be what I am. So, you know, I being just a regular bloke... regular straight white male.
What, 1/16th Maori?
Correct.
Is that correct? I know. It's on your Wikipedia page.
Yes. Not enough that I can do jokes about it.
Really? Yeah, do you know, I've seen you do a bit and say something and then go, and I'm a 16th Maori or a 16th in particular flavour of it.
Iwi, yes.
And I did, sorry, say again?
Iwi. It's the tribe.
You're 1/16th Iwi.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. But you, it was definitely, you were saying it almost as a little... A comedy climb down after saying something else.
Yeah, yeah, no, I like. It's something I've been exploring a bit lately. Is the race thing, and I think I live in a this sort of liberal white liberal bubble, and sometimes it just gets a little bit claustrophobic, mm-hmm. and you can't people. You know, you talk about race or anything like that, and I just it starts to irritate me. So I've been talking about it on stage a little bit, not in a racist way, certainly.
No, of course.
But you know, the accent thing always fascinates me. I've been doing stuff about that, about how you're allowed to do a French accent or a Russian accent,
yes,
or a Spanish accent, or possibly, or certainly an Irish accent, but you can't do an Indian accent.
Mm.
I don't know, but anyway, kind of beside the point.
Is that, well, just to digress on that briefly, just on the issue of race and your 1/16th Iwi's,
sure, yes.
Has that had any effect on your career? Has that, have you worked, I mean, is there a Maori circuit, like there's a black circuit in the UK?
There's not, but I did get invited to do the Maori and Pacific Island comedy show years ago, and I said no 100 times, and they kept asking me, so in the end I did, but I wrote a new set for it. It was like a TV show,
yeah.
And I wrote a new set for it about how I'm a Maori that I have to tell you about, you know, the fact that I am.
Yes, I see what you mean.
Yeah,
yeah, okay.
And you know, like just having a walk out and everyone sort of looked at me and I went, "Yep, that's right. Yeah, you're at the right show. Don't worry about it." Yeah. So that's the only thing I probably ever got from.
Okay.
Know, yeah, yeah.
Okay. And there isn't really a cultural element to your work, particularly.
No, not particularly. No.
And is that why is that? Is that because it's just not a factor of your life?
Not a huge one. No, I'd like it to be more probably, but it's a part of my life. It's through my mother's side, and we just didn't really. Live a particularly Maori cultural life, I guess. We lived a pretty normal, white, middle-class life.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? Yeah. We didn't live like that. We lived like normal. That's kind of, that sort of says, well, you know, that reveals your...
Yeah, when
I said, I'm not saying that reveals a prejudice. That reveals how comprehensively, I guess, that's, you know... part of your identity.
When I say normal, I mean boring.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Oh, you'd like to have been more Maori.
Yeah, absolutely.
Why is that?
Oh, it's just more interesting, isn't it? Having a rich culture like that and something to... I don't know. It's just it's a wonderful ancient culture. Whereas, you know, I don't know. Maybe doesn't everybody kind of wish they were...
Yeah, I certainly. Well, I asked if anyone was in from Scotland the other night, and one bloke went, "Yeah," and I went, "Oh, whereabouts in Scotland?" And his mate went, "He's not," and he said in a Kiwi accent, "He was right." Like, no, I'm more like, you know, my granny sort of thing.
I think would like to have a connection. Yeah, I think this more so in New Zealand than other places I've been as well. It's just that white New Zealanders kind of because we're relatively new here. You know, I guess they don't feel that much identity with it, you know, white middle class New Zealanders, and so there's quite a lot of that. I do that too. I've got any Irish in, I quite often say, and people will say yes, and you go, "Oh, how long have you been here?" "Oh, I was born here, but my grandfather's Irish." Well, then you're not really Irish.
Sure, yeah. Sure. That's interesting. I've had a few Kiwi guests on the show.
Mm-hmm.
Are you my first technical Kiwi guest? I'll be embarrassed if I had someone last year that I forgot.
Jared.
But no, I had Jared yet. No, I was going to do a live one with Jared. He pulled. Fuck you, Jared.
That's what Jared.
He had a sitcom. It's cool. We're cool about it.
he had a sitcom.
Yeah.
Sorry, he had a sitcom.
Yeah, he, at the time he was like, "Oh, I've got a sitcom," and then afterwards spoke to him. He was like, "Yeah, it was like one line." Okay, that's fine.
he still said, "Fuck you, buddy."
Yeah. But just in terms of the culture of being a white or a mostly white New Zealander. Like, are there, what does that culture mean to you? Is it anything beyond a sort of, "I'm a normal bloke with my normal mates and I've got to suffer jokes about sheep when I travel"?
There's definitely some aspects to New Zealand white culture, you know, the kind of laid backness. I think that's a reputation we have. You know, going to, you know, all the London things as well when I was over there, which I didn't really live that life of the typical New Zealander in London in a flat with 28 other people.
Sure.
And doing the haka on the tube and with my shirt off.
Okay.
Yeah. We're certainly searching for identity constantly. You know, there's the rugby and the sheep and the... I'm struggling right now to even think of it. Yeah.
Mm. Okay. I want to talk a bit about writing. Loads of stuff we can talk about. I just wanted to talk this just to finish the story of the
journey. Yes.
I tried not to say it. You said the word. This is my journey. But you.
I think I said it because you started to say it.
I did say it. I can't put that on you. That was my fault. But you came back here with this girl.
Yes.
And you married the girl.
Yes, I married the girl.
And you got a kid. Yep. So, but in terms of professionally, when you got back here, did you feel like, "Whoa, ready, break, I've been to the UK, I'm covered in this glow of, like, I'm a super pro now"?
Yeah, that certainly showed when I would come back every year to do the festival.
Yes.
It's another New Zealand thing, maybe it's a colonial thing, is that we still look for overseas legitimacy in our art.
Yeah.
So, for example... even to take it away from comedy, someone like Lord, who is huge overseas, I'm not sure, you know, she broke overseas before she did here. But as soon as she was, you know, number one in the US, and suddenly she was, you know, a national hero. And
number one in our hearts.
And number one
hearts. The pop star of our hearts, yeah.
And there are exceptions to that. There are people who are just successful here, music-wise or comedy-wise, who aren't overseas, but it definitely helps. It definitely kind of fast tracks you. So when I came back for the comedy festival every year, it definitely helped, and I'd put on my posters, you know, fresh back from the UK and
did
things
you,
like
did
that.
Did you ever experience any resentment from UK from Kiwi acts who hadn't been to the UK? Was there ever any sense of like, "Oh, here he comes"?
Yes. Yeah. And
you don't need to name any names, obviously. No, but you know, but you could talk about the experience of that, of how that made you feel, or was that frustrating? You think, "Well, of course I'm better. I've been working hard."
Yeah, I think, yeah, maybe there was this resentment of, or a feeling that I thought I was better and wasn't necessarily, you know, that I just had another level of confidence / arrogance now, so, you know, I'm not sure if that necessarily endeared me to some people, but most people were absolutely fine and were happy to... you know, see me improve or whatever. But when I came back for good, I mean, we were coming back anyway because we were sort of done and we wanted to, you know, come back and get married and have a family and things like that. But I fortuitously got a panel show when I was here.
This is 7 days.
7 days.
Which is, and I've looked, I've never seen 7 days. Sure. I'd like to watch the one that Acaster did one the other week.
Yeah, he was
but,
great.
But it seems to me, from the description of it online, is that it's kind of a cross between all of the UK. It's like there's a bit of Buzzcocks, there's a bit of Have I Got News For You, there's a bit of Mock the Week, there's a bit of...
Absolutely.
Yeah, all of that sort of stuff. It's like the panel show with all the ideas in it.
Absolutely, but, you know, it's topical news, 7 days, so that's the basis of it. And, yeah, I guess probably closer to Mock the Week than Have I Got News For You, but we definitely have our own spin and have our own games
absolutely.
And all that sort of thing.
I wasn't slagging off.
No, it's fine. But yeah, I guess Mark the Week would be its biggest influence.
Sure. Okay.
Other way around.
And so
influenced
you.
By,
yeah. And so when you got that panel show, do you think that was because. Do you think the fact that you'd been away played a part in that?
Oh, possibly. The producers of the show, who are still the producers of the show, were just became fans of mine and they just gave me that break.
Mm.
And having said that, we didn't know it was going to be a success. So,
okay.
It wasn't like they.
You were in it for the very beginning, were you?
Yeah. I did the pilot and all that sort of stuff. And I didn't know that they necessarily thought that it was going to be as successful as it has been. They weren't like gifting me a golden ticket.
Sure.
But they definitely gave me a shot. And it, fortunately, it's been, much like Mock the Week, it's just a ratings bonanza here.
And that must have changed your life from, staying on someone's couch.
Yeah.
You know, like now you are a very viable commodity, are you? Are you in demand? What's the bulk of the work that you're doing? Given that there isn't, as I understand it, there's not like a circuit in, or a circuit as a British comic would understand it.
Sure.
Or is there?
More so now than ever. That show, 7 days... plus the success of Rhys Darby and Flight of the Conchords has really sort of had a renaissance of comedy in New Zealand. There was always a bit of a cultural cringe about New Zealand comedy. And, there still is to a certain degree. I actually thought it was unique to New Zealand, but I used to hear people say that they didn't like British comedy in Britain occasionally, and I used to think, oh, right, okay. Because there's people that would still say, oh, New Zealanders aren't very good at comedy. But okay. But that's absolutely minimal now compared to what it used to be. We used to, every year, there would be an article in our major paper, the New Zealand Herald, saying, why aren't New Zealanders funny? There would be like
really?
A...
Really?
Yeah, every year. And it just stopped. And I think it was, A, the overseas success of, particularly the big, big success of the Concords and Rhys, and the local success of 7 days. That showed that we did have comedians who were funny and good, and it was because before 7 days, it annoyed me so much because Brendan and Rhys and Jared and myself,
been a lot of funny people for a long time.
We'd all gone to the UK and done well ish, we'd all held our own in the UK, and it was like, well, we're clearly okay if we're getting work on the toughest circuit in the world. So that kind of all changed. So there is a circuit. Bulk of my work now is a fair amount of telly and touring.
And when you say telly, do you mean panel games, specifically 7 days, or are there other sort of things?
You're doing 7 days, but also, just like other stand-up shows. There's quite a few stand-up shows.
Are you like a TV personality? Do you go on, cooking programs and stuff like that?
No, I do not.
Would you like to?
I say no to them.
Okay, you get asked though.
I've never been interested in being a celebrity. I'm quite happy being a well-known comic.
Yeah.
But I never wanted to do a celebrity. I've never done, because we don't have tabloids here like you guys do, Red Tops, but we have women's magazines, which sounds like a sexist thing to say, but it's genuinely what they're called. So there's Women's Weekly, Women's Day, New Idea, and there's another one, and they do all the sort of celebrity gossip.
Gotcha.
But not so much gossip. although some gossip, but they do all the, we had a baby and here's it photos.
Well, I was going to say, in the context of having had a kid now, mm-hmm. kids?
Two girls.
Is there any part of you that thinks like, let's just invite them around my house and get $100,000 from them? Or whatever,
the money is nowhere near that, because it's New Zealand.
I do not speak as someone who has ever been afforded this opportunity.
it might be in the UK if you're a big enough star.
Sure.
You know, I guess if they went to McIntyre's home, that
might get a fair old
chunk of money.
Yeah.
But we're just too small. But there is, there is financial offers, and and I don't judge other people for doing it. I totally understand it. And, they do great things with that money. And they go, right, well, that's their university paid for, in one fell swoop. But it's just not something I've ever been interested in, and certainly not my wife isn't interested in it either. So I don't go to openings of things and red carpet events, and
sure.
I try and avoid them at all costs, really. And it may have been a slight detriment of my career slightly in New Zealand, because I just don't enjoy it, and I've never wanted to be a showbiz personality. I just want to be a comic.
Talking about the recognition of stand-up as comedy, as an actual creative force of a standard, of a high mm-hmm. standard in New Zealand, do you think there is a qualitative difference overall between, say, the top Trumps of global comedy?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think what are the differences between the UK and New Zealand?
You mean stylistically?
Yeah, stylistically. And also, I suppose what I'm wondering is, would you be happy with the level that you've attained here?
Mm-hmm.
Would you go back to the UK and go, check me out, I'm actually a big deal in New Zealand? Saying that, but in terms of, do you think you would slot in at an appropriate, at an equivalent level in the UK?
No, and in fact, I'm going back this year. I'm coming in August, and I'm not doing the festival, but...
I thought I was getting exclusive. Jesus Christ. No, that's good. I like that my listeners can come and see you.
Yeah, cool. I hope they do. I'm just coming back to do the clubs I like, actually.
Okay.
Because I miss them, and I haven't been in a long time, so... And that's...
They're all exactly the same.
Yeah. But I think... Okay, so here's a difference between British audiences and New Zealand audiences. Although it's changing for the better in New Zealand, but British audiences just know how to be an audience. And they just... Most of the time, they just give it up. They just go, right, we're here for the night. And, obviously you have to prove yourself in the first couple of minutes, but once you do, then you're away.
Right? Okay.
New Zealanders are still just that little bit more... I guess suspicious, and they go, Mickey D calls it they're shoppers.
Yeah, okay.
They go, I like that joke, I don't like that one. Oh, I like that one, I laugh at that one. Not that one.
Yeah.
Whereas British audiences are just, it's rock and roll.
Yeah.
You walk out on stage at the Birmingham Glee or the Comedy Store or something like that, and it's rock and roll, man. It's cool. And I do miss that a little bit. So yeah, I'm going back for 4 weeks. That's a difference. Stylistically, New Zealand comedians, I would say, they do want to be your mate a little bit more than I always equated New Zealand comedy more with the Canadians, and Americans a bit more like the Aussies, and Britain somewhere in between. There's this the kind of swagger that Aussies and Americans seem to have, that kind of, they'll tell you how it is, whereas
that's interesting. Yeah. I've heard from a couple of UK acts, and I think I've experienced myself as well here, the tall poppy syndrome.
Yes,
which isn't really a thing in the UK.
No.
I hadn't ever heard of it before I went to Australia last year, actually. Mm-hmm. They're big on it there. And what I understand to mean from it is people paying you kind of backhanded compliments. Like audience members coming up to you afterwards and going, so how do you think that went? Because they don't want to accept that you have a higher status post-gig. Am I right? Is that the thing?
You're absolutely right. I used to, Jared Christmas used to run a gig called the Four Kiwis gig every month in Chiswick. And, I'd work all month, around the place and doing gigs everywhere. And then I would do that gig. And it would be the only one, even if you had a great gig, after the gig, someone would come up to you and go, that was quite good, actually.
Yeah, that's exactly
actually?
It. That was quite good, actually. Yeah. Don't you think for a minute that I expected it to be good or that
no.
I'm satisfied? Yeah, that's it. Why is that? Where does that come from?
I don't know. I don't know. I've thought about it and thought about it, and it's the most frustrating thing. But it's cultural cringe. I don't know what we always.
What do you mean by that? I've heard that phrase here, but not at home.
No, really. It's just we always think everybody else is doing it better than us.
Really?
Because we're a little bit, you know, give it a crack, mate. You know, and you know, we're not a wealthy country. You know, well, yeah, we are compared to some, but. You know, we have similar GDP to Wales, I think.
Yeah, okay.
So everything has always been a little bit kind of do-it-yourself, homegrown kind of. We call it number eight wired here, because
number say again?
Number eight wired.
Okay.
And it's a phrase that comes from the kind of wire you use to on a fence on a sheep farm is number eight wire. It's the thickness. There's numbers nine and there's number 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And the most common is number eight. And there's kind of an old cliche that says that a New Zealand farmer can make anything work with a piece of number eight wire. So that kind of phrase now is that it's you know, it's kind of a bit do-it-yourself, and it's kind of
things
together.
Yeah.
And that, I think that's where the cultural cringe comes from, that there hasn't been just high production values on things.
I understand.
Yeah.
I understand.
I think that's where it comes
from. And so that the tall poppy thing comes from
maybe things being a little bit crap.
Yes, I see.
Occasionally.
Okay. That's interesting. That's interesting. Yeah, I was watching some of your TV. Watching some of your local TV.
Oh, yes.
And I was astonished by how much of it was Americanized.
Oh, actually. Yeah, that's the other thing.
I mean, there's you know, just channels, like channel, I don't know, the exact numbers, but before you get, like, to find the infomercial channels, to find the advertising, hey, this is my Ninja Bullet food processor, you don't need to go higher than sort of 8. Do you know what I mean?
No, right,
in the UK,
right.
You're like, right, okay, 30, now these are the...
Yeah, that was the other thing, is that, particularly with New Zealand TV, we bought the best TV available from the United Kingdom and from the United States.
Yeah, sure.
Like,
sure.
We went, right, well, we'll have your five best comedies. So we bought, you know, Fawlty Towers and Monty Python and Blackadder, and we never bought Titty Titty Bang Bang.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you don't see, you only see the cream of the crop, and you think, right, well, British comedy is perfect then.
Yes, okay, okay. That's
and you don't see the, we never saw the failures. And the same with American. I mean, Mike. I mean, we do occasionally see the failures, but they're few. And just, I can't imagine how many failed sitcoms there are in the UK. In the US at one, any one time.
Yes, God.
That are doing its first and last season. But we never get to see them. So you only see the successes, and then we give something a crack, and it's not a success. It's just a numbers game.
That's really interesting. That's really interesting to think that you're battling the best of comedy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or documentary or drama.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever we give something a go, if it is a failure, it just looks so bad compared to the absolute cream of British television.
Mm. That's interesting. That's an interesting place to be culturally at the moment as a comedy producer yourself. You know, as a creator. Of stuff. Okay. So when are you back in the UK?
August. I'll be in August. I'm doing the two comedians. I'm doing the Birmingham Glee, and I'm doing some gigs in London as well.
You're not going to wander up to Edinburgh?
I think I'll come up and have a look, yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Excellent. We talked a little bit about writing at the beginning. We've kind of done our time now.
Sure.
I just to tie it up, you said at the beginning about mentoring other comics. Mm-hmm. And it's one of my favourite things about New Zealand, is there is this sense of nourishing them. And you mentioned I don't know if you mentioned it, or I made a note to ask you about class comedy.
Yes.
Which is like a comedy for young people thing that is all within, it's almost like this one central body of the comedy festival. Scott Blanks and the Classic are totally knitted in with that.
Uh-huh.
And everything, you know, the Billy T Awards and the Fred Awards and the class comedy, it's all sort of within one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really exciting model, I think, for someone certainly for myself, used to hundreds of different satellite gigs, some loose idea that there's an industry, Chortle kind of looking at it and sometimes down on it, and, you know, kind of, you know, it's piecemeal, it's patchwork in the UK, and then you've got, it all is kind of geared around building up to and dragged down by Edinburgh, and, you know what I mean? And all of which is 100 different organisations squabbling, there's a free fringe, bang, there's now 4 free fringes, and they're all squabbling, there's the big 4 or 5 venues, plus there's the stand, the local things, plus there's all the other stuff in between. And here it seems very, you know, not just condensed, not just smaller, but more unified. And so the idea that you're mentoring other comics, I've never spoken to another comic from Britain who's gone, well, I was mentoring this comic. So what is that? What is that process? Because in some ways, that's kind of what this show leans itself towards accidentally, you know. That wasn't really a question so much as a big expansive monologue. So what is that mentoring?
You just summed up comedy in like a minute. It's amazing. It's a great process because you look at your own process and
it's almost like having an apprentice, is it?
Yeah.
They're always saying, you see those adverts for businesses, have an apprentice, it helps your business, you know.
It's something I've always done. Not everyone does it, and that's not a criticism, you know. Not everyone's got time or the inclination, but I don't know, I've always done it. I guess I love this job. I genuinely love this job, and I kind of want to share that.
And so what form does that take? Do you pick one person a year and go, I'm going to spend some time helping you?
It's not even as methodical as that. I just sometimes I'll see, like I've got someone opening, doing 5 minutes of my show every night of the comedy festival.
Okay.
And she was just someone I saw on a...
She's like a 5 minute support act at the beginning.
Yeah.
Great.
And...
We should name her.
Her name's Louise Boving.
Yes, I know Louise. She's a friend of the show. Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. Hey, happy days.
And I just saw her. I thought she was really unique and really funny and really dark. And I've done it before. A couple of the ex-class comedians.
Yes. Which is like a comedy for young people thing.
Yeah, at school.
Yes, okay.
Yeah, so it's a school's program.
That goes around into schools?
In Auckland and Wellington, yeah.
Okay.
So I think they do a like a lunchtime gig, which is obviously clean and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And then kids will come up and say if they're interested in doing a workshop after school, and then it's kind of a workshop / audition. And then they choose one or two from each school, and then it goes into an intensive training program, and then they end up doing a gig and a big showcase during the comedy festival. I don't know. There might be a sense of narcissism to my mentoring.
I'm sure it's flattering to think that you're passing something on.
Yeah.
But so what are the key things? And let's finish on this. What are the key things that you try to pass on? You mentioned one of them earlier on about...
telling them you're funny.
Telling them you're funny. But what are the other... What are the principles for you? If you... I suppose whenever I ask people things like this, I'm always thinking, Ben Hurley, if you walked out of here and got hit by a bus and this was your last message to comedy, what are the things, what are the key principles that you go, do you know what, for me, these are the most important things?
Truth. So your own truth. So never try and be something that you're not. Don't try and be a surreal comic if you don't have that kind of mind. I don't have that kind of mind. And I love surreal comics. And I love Noel Fielding and, a lot of the whimsical comics. I'm just not a whimsical comic. I don't have that kind of mind. I'm genuinely impressed by that kind of comedy. So absolute 100% be a version of your true self, because I don't think it's funny otherwise. And love it. You've got to love it. It's the best job in the world. If you're doing it for a paycheck, then you should give up. If you're doing it to be famous, give up. If you're doing it to go on to other things, if you want to be a film director or be in sitcoms and that's why you're doing stand-up comedy, then give up. Get the fuck out of my industry. Come and be a comic because you love doing stand-up comedy and you love making audiences laugh. So that's another one.
Thank you very much. Cheers, Ben. That's great.
So that was Ben. Many thanks to him for coming on the show. Really good to catch up with him. And a lot of sensible shit being talked there too as well. I really enjoyed that record. That was great fun. That's everything. I'm just going to sign off. No, I'm not. I've forgotten the last few shows to plug the Audible link. This is a way you can get a free trial of Audible, which, as you know, is the audiobook download site. If you go to audible.co.uk/cc for Comedians Comedian, pick an audiobook, then you get that one for free with your membership, which you can cancel at any time if you're not enjoying it. For a certain period of time, maybe a month or something, you'll have to check the registration details. I certainly haven't done that. But if you do go to audible.co.uk/cc, then I get a couple of quid every time a member joins. So I normally recommend a specific author. I'm going to admit, all I've been reading is Jack Reacher. I know, by Lee Childs. He comes from Coventry. I feel like I should support him. He's just an enormous, you know, 10'5" sort of drifter, really. If you don't know Jack Reacher, he is. He was in that Tom Cruise film. Tom Cruise played someone double his height. And his two abilities are winning all fights and deducing stuff to a ludicrous degree. I've been really enjoying them. They've been keeping me going on the way plane travel. So get some bloody Jack Reacher audiobooks on your drive. This show was brought to you by me, Stuart Goldsmith, and co-produced by Nathan Wood. All details at comedianscomedian.com. If you've enjoyed it, do feel free to donate. And if you don't want to donate, please share it with a friend. Thanks for listening. I've got a couple of really good ones in the can coming up with Luke Heggie, Jared Christmas and Michelle Acourt. I'm going to record a few more this week before I come back. So some good names you'll know and names you won't coming up very soon. I'll speak to you then.
Hey, marketers, advertisers and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines. Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.